Today, we bought a home. I will not pretend that it is a vast, sprawling palace, which it is not, or that it is even a mansion, which it also is not. Although Sir Edward Coke did say long ago that a man's home is his castle, and in that, of course, he was eminently correct. Our house is a modest one, I suppose, with only 3 bedrooms and 2 baths. But it is a house that was fashioned by proud and careful hands. And as I stand here now, looking at it through the trees with as much satisfaction as if I had built it myself, I can suddenly say with perfect assurance that aside from love and possibly moonbeams, I've never really seen a moonbeam, the most beautiful thing in all the world is one's own home. With me, it is love at first sight, reciprocated, because our new house is much, much more than simple bricks and mortar. Though only just finished, it is at once a living thing. How else could it stand there beckoning us with such warmth and promise that I half expect the shutters to swing open by themselves in welcome? Already it has become an unquestioned part of us, and we of it. The future, you see, is already here. From now on, and for time without end, this house will protect us and our children, commiserate with our tears, echo to our laughter, keep our little secrets, sigh over our occasional lapses, honor our friends by their visits, speak well of our accomplishments. From time to time, inevitably, when one of us is ill, it will also be gently hushed, as a good, understanding house always is in times of sickness. And like anything else of inestimable value, it will doubtless give us a problem or two. Mostly, though, looking through the trees at the white shutters, I think of my house as a bastion of security and a sanctuary of repose. For someone once said, I am bigger than anything that can happen to me. All these things, sorrow, misfortune, and suffering, are outside my door. I am in the house, and I have the key. And that should be enough for any man. It is odd that writers and poets who pay such homage to transient things like rainbows and waterfalls should also devoutly believe in houses. But they do. I gaze at my own new house and remember Ralph Waldo Emerson, who must have been referring to the ineffable joy of exquisite creation when he wrote, "Nature paints the best part of a picture, carves the best part of the statue, builds the best part of the house." I think of John Ruskin, "Therefore, when we build, let us think that we build forever." And of course, there was William Shakespeare, who snorted defiantly from the passionate breast of one of his characters in King Henry VI to say, "Sir, he made a chimney in my father's house, and the bricks are alive at this day to testify it." I'm in the house, and I have the key, and I'm gratified beyond all expression that it is an American house, for American houses are the finest in the world. I say that unequivocally, although I am not a completely qualified expert, but perhaps you should know that because of my profession, I have rented and endured more than my share of houses in Europe, and each one of them inevitably called attention to itself because of some wondrous and occasionally hair-raising idiosyncrasy. As a result, I consider myself something of an authority on the unpredictability of European housing. I don't know whether it was the house itself or what, but I once lived in a house in Zehlendorf, a section of Berlin, which boasted spiders as big as Pomeranians. For some unaccountable reason I do not profess to understand, that house at Lima Strasse 14 was the only house in all of Zehlendorf with a proper atmosphere or equipment for producing spiders. Looking back to another city and another time, I'm still rather surprised to find that I survived without incident the renting of a house in Amsterdam, which I belatedly discovered had been condemned in the 17th century, and then, for some 250 years, had successfully defied time, nature, and the authorities with the mysterious sort of protective insouciance ancient houses seem to cloak themselves in when summoned to the accounting. Whether houses in London are worse than any others, I have never been able to decide, but I suspect so. In our first house in London, in any case, the furnace exploded with such shattering regularity that we quickly established, ahead of the doctor, the greengrocer, and all our friends, the telephone number, Abbey 3434, as our first priority in telephone numbers, that being the number for the emergency service of the London Gas Board. In another house owned by a spinster, we found the closets inexplicably filled with cricket bats, and the house itself somehow reflected this unorthodox lady's personality by regularly divesting itself of its windows. They simply fell out of their frames without explanation, usually dropping into an adjacent park on one side or onto the street on another side. In a third London house, doubtless the strangest one of all, and quite possibly the work of a mad architect, the kitchen, for some reason, was by far the largest room among nine, and in the winter was so cold, my wife had to abandon her dignity completely and cook with a fur coat on. This particular kitchen also had uneven floors, which we discovered only when she found herself being pursued and ultimately trapped in a corner by a demented, pulsating washing machine, which suddenly took off from its moorings and chased her across the room. The only commendable feature of this same house, in fact, was that it did boast a bidet, which should be standard everywhere, but which seems to be generally misunderstood in America, or else its absence can be traced to some peculiar form of misplaced modesty, which a European would find hard to credit, as do I. A bidet has many uses, all of them eminently sensible, and if you happen to own a dachshund, as we did, you will even find that it makes an ideal bed for him if properly lined. The shape is perfect for dachshunds, they being supple fellows, though it is not so good for other breeds, I suppose. In any case, the plumbing in all our houses in Europe seemed to be our greatest frustration. Faucets often produced little more than spates of rust accompanied by an embarrassed trickle of water. And in order to flush a toilet, one was generally forced to approach the handle or chain with all the elan of a concert violinist beginning a delicate Haydn masterwork. It had to be played carefully. The rhythm of a spirited polka or schottische attempted on the handle or chain, or a forthright John Philip Sousa march, produced no results whatever except a fitful, inconclusive coughing spell. Success demanded the gossamer touch of the virtuoso. Unfortunately, only a few have it. All this travail, of course, has served its purpose. Renting bad houses with bad plumbing in Europe was a chastening experience which should have put us off houses forever. Instead, perhaps because we like to dream, it only made us wonder all the more if someday we shouldn't own our own superior house in America with its own superior plumbing. Now we have one within the other. We stalked a dream, and finally we captured it in the shape of that house through the trees. But putting dreams to work is not so simple. They must not be allowed just to sit around. Instead, they must be watered and fed and encouraged in every way. Sometimes dreams must be scolded for getting out of hand. They are fragile things and should always be nurtured in a greenhouse at a constant temperature. When we returned to America with our dream, which was young and not yet safely oriented, we had already heard of self-defrosting refrigerators, electric can openers, automatic ice parts of Europe where we lived. But there were some things we were not prepared for at all. We were literally astonished, for example, to find that one company alone in America produces no less than 664 variations of toilets for the home, including a remarkable self-ventilating toilet so modern it seems to have been snatched willy-nilly from the year 2000, though the principle, like all good principles, is a simple one. Our dream of owning our own home was now full-blown, but the actual decision to buy a house took some soul-searching. If we wanted a house, then why did we want a house? And if we bought one, could we afford it? The hollow voice of Shakespeare was heard again. When we mean to build, we first survey the plot, then draw the model. And when we see the figure of the house, then must we rate the cost of the erection. When the moment came to make the critical decision to buy or not to buy, I called on another spirit, the restless ghost of that one-time great showman, Billy Rose, who had an extraordinary talent for separating his head from his heart when contemplating a theatrical production. When all the facts were in from whatever precincts had been consulted, Mr. Rose took a large pad of yellow foolscap and slowly drew a line down the center. The left-hand column was headed yes, the right-hand column was no. Meticulously, he listed the reasons for going ahead and the reasons for not going ahead. Only Billy Rose knows how many plays and musicals failed to reach Broadway because the no's, if even by a whisker, outweighed the yeses. Billy was not a dreamer. It was not quite so easy for us. Aside from the fact that my head does not suffer figures gladly, buying a house is an emotional experience accommodated more easily, I suspect, by wives than by husbands, though certainly I, as a husband, wanted a house. But on the other side of the coin, I had to consider that this would probably be the biggest single investment of my entire lifetime. I was not toying with the purchase of a stereo or a color TV. This was a house. In the end, of course, the yeses far exceeded the noes. Even Billy Rose would have bought the house. There were a host of reasons for our buying a home, most of them serious, but some, I suppose, faintly frivolous, such as being able to turn up the hi-fi to ear-splitting level without bothering the people next door, or raising rabbits, or letting my son play the trumpet, or beat up a sister over 15 full rounds without someone calling the police. We also have the privacy we want so much, the places to put things, the joy of partnership in ownership, the pleasure of our independence. Though I am still outside, still looking through the trees, still marveling at the fulfillment of an abiding dream, I know that from now on, for time without end, that this house will be our home. And already I can say in paraphrase of still another writer who believed in houses, Utopia is the house we dwell in every day. And that should be enough for any man.